Welcome to the Context Matters podcast. I am your host, Cindy Parker. I am an educator, explorer, writer, and speaker. I enjoy gathering around the table with interesting people who have different life experiences from me. And then we get to talk about God, Bible, theology, and other tangentially related subjects. Your voice is always welcomed around this table. You can reach out to me and let me know what you're thinking about through my website, narrativeofplace.com. Today, we have the privilege to sit around the podcast table with Dr. Joy Schrader, who is a professor of church history at Capital University, where she teaches undergrad religion courses, but she also teaches courses at Trinity Lutheran Seminary. Last week, we talked about the newly released book called Voices Long Silenced that she co-authored with Marian Taylor. This is such a valuable and important book. They compiled a long survey of female scriptural interpreters of different denominations, different classes, and different ethnic backgrounds. I am completely in awe of the patient work that they had to do to pull some of these women out of obscurity, and I'm so grateful that they did it. Last week, we talked a bit about why this book is so important and how someone even goes about finding these lost voices. Today, we get to hear personal stories of these women. We start with a Jewish voice in late antiquity and end with an African-American woman from my hometown of Philly. Along the way, we will meet women traveling to the land of the Bible and nuns who are exegeting scripture. I love these stories. There's just so much to be curious about. Let's start with the female Jewish voice and talk about chasing down small details to hear her voice. Lean in and enjoy the conversation.
So there was a woman named Bereria, and we're not 100% sure whether she lived in the second century or a little bit before that, but the kind of the first reference to it is in no later than 131 of the Common Era. And what happened was, as the ancient rabbis, the sages, were trying to discern what things are clean or unclean. In other words, what are the things that you can bring into your house without immersing them in the bath? So what's clean and unclean? And they're compiling a list, you know, pots, pans, swords. No, that's unclean. But women's jewelry is clean. Does it need the immersion? And they're wondering, what about a door latch? So something, you know, that you use to keep the door from, you know, kind of swinging open. And the sages are talking about that. And then the quote is, "A claustra," which is a door latch, "Rabbi Tarfon declares unclean, and the sages declare clean." And Bereria says, "One lets it fall from the doorway and hangs it on the next doorway on the Sabbath. These things were said before Rabbi Joshua. He said Bereria has spoken well." So her argument is that if you're using a door latch on the Sabbath, then it must be clean. And then Rabbi Joshua, he's a rabbi who died around 131 of the Common Era. That's why we can kind of date it from then. He said that she's spoken well. So in rabbinic literature, what happens is that people will, you know, you'll see different points of view, but then the different rabbis will weigh in. And that was sort of how it got settled, that she's the one who said that. We don't know much about her. She may have had a number of other rulings or opinions, and that one got preserved. Interestingly, a little bit later in the Mishnah, then that same saying got attributed to Rabbi Joshua. So the rabbi who is reported as preserving her saying is now attributed to her, or to him rather. So that's one of those challenging things. We don't necessarily know what things in the rabbinic literature and the Jewish law may actually have been decided on by women. And there are cases where a rabbi will say, well, my sister said this, or my sister said that she learned this from my father. And in rabbinic literature, as well, you know, the chain of transmission is really important. You know, like, I heard it from so-and-so who heard it from so-and-so. And women could be part of that chain of transmission which was very significant.
Well, talk about noticing small details as you're reading. I think those are details people would skip over. But when you're looking for them and you go, oh, look, learned it from a sister, learned it from a mother, you know, and every time that happens, you go, oh, look, they were having those conversations. They were involved. They were educated enough to contribute a thought, and that thought was preserved. And that is really important.
And sometimes historians and other scholars have assumed that women only learned, like they learned what their mothers taught them regarding, you know, separating the dough for the Sabbath bread or this or that, and that they just passed it on and then checked in with a rabbi if they needed to. But in fact, there really can be no doubt that mothers and grandmothers and aunts and friends were teaching them. This is the reason why we're doing it. And you also would need to have a certain amount of knowledge of why you're doing what you're doing so that you could consult a rabbi if a question comes up. Mm-hmm. So I read as much as I can, and I look for the little details there, a reference to a woman saying this or reading that. So that's what it takes, a kind of obsessiveness about finding all the women.
Yeah. There's an interesting, I've been thinking about Greco-Roman society a little bit more, and because I'm currently doing a project dealing with this Second Temple Judaism and trying to untangle all these different things. But one of the things that has become very obvious is that status is almost more important than gender, because a woman of high status has a lot more power and options available to her than a male slave, for instance. So, mm-hmm. So status is something that is really significant, but so is the religion you align yourself with. And so when we have early Christianity, before it was a legal religion, how can we untangle like status and your choice of religion, maybe in particular Christianity? And in your book, you tell stories of Perpetua. So maybe we can use her as an example.
Yes. Perpetua is a North African martyr, you know, from Carthage, was persecuted, executed in 203 of the Common Era. She was a high status woman. Then she was arrested at a point where she was a catechumen, that is someone preparing for baptism. And that was a point at which the Roman authorities liked to arrest people because they thought if we can get them before they're baptized, we can stave this off. But you actually have these fervent people ready to convert. Perpetua was a high-born woman, married. If she were a widow, we would have heard that, but we don't hear anything about her husband. We hear that she was educated. The narrator, who kind of frames her prison diary, calls her liberally educated, which means kind of educated in the liberal arts. She didn't receive the kind of like really advanced rhetorical training that high status men would, but she was able to write vividly in Latin. So she's highborn, but put in prison. And then when it's sort of like miserable and damp and so forth, she actually is able to use her status to get visitors and get moved to a better place. And the governor really doesn't want her to be martyred because she's high status, and that's not a good thing. Her father, who's not Christian, begs her to kind of renounce Christianity. So she comes from this high status setting, but she's still vulnerable to persecution, arrest, and so forth. But the fact that she's actually literate and highborn means that she's treated as a de facto leader of the community. There's another man who's their teacher, and so he's very, you know, like he is really revered. But they think if you pray, you'll have some visions. So there's this hope that she'll pray for visions, and she has visions, and the visions interpret scripture. So she has a dream in which she steps on the head of a dragon, which is clearly an allusion to Genesis 3 about the woman stepping on the head of the serpent. And in her visions, they're like echoes of the book of Revelation, the crowds and that kind of thing. But we also get hints of her pre-Christian, the Greco-Roman religion, because her vision of a brother who died before hearing about Jesus reminds us of the miseries of Hades, of, you know, the Greek afterlife, where her brother is kind of miserable, and his face is kind of disfigured with a kind of cancer that he had suffered from. And he's thirsty, and he's reaching for this water, and the water in the basin recedes, which reminds us of Tantalus, the mythological figure who's in Hades and then trying to eat, and then the fruit always pulls back. So she weaves these things together. So that's a piece of how her pre-Christian and her Christian training, which was probably only a few months, if anything, but it might have been an intense instructional period. She may only have heard scripture rather than reading it, even though she was able to read, but she may have gotten it that way. So we have class, the fact that she was able to write. And here's one of those things people have sometimes thought, oh, a woman really wouldn't have written a prison diary. So it must be a man who, you know, kind of created that so that the Perpetua we have there is like a sock puppet for his views. People who've done the careful look at the Latin, they'll actually notice that the narrator who starts out and then tells the rest of the account clearly has had classical rhetorical training that you almost can't help but reveal, even if you're trying to write in the voice of a woman. And so if we say, why should we doubt that Paul wrote from prison, or some of these other men who wrote prison diaries or letters, why should we think that a woman couldn't do that too? And it was sort of presumed, no one really questioned at that time that a woman might be able to read and write.
When you talk about her as a de facto leader of the community, is that of the community of Christians that are being held in this prison system?
Thank you. Yes, she wouldn't have been a leader in the Christian community that she would have been baptized into, although I expect there might have been some respect given to her due to her status. But once she and a group of catechumens are arrested, they seem to be looking to her for guidance. They believe that she's going to be having visions and communication with God, but she also has a kind of assertiveness. She kind of, you know, like tells the guards that we need to be in a more comfortable place, and she's able to kind of direct some things from her kind of force of personality, but also status, because she would be higher status than the men guarding her.
It just brings to light even how much she had to lose. So then her fervor in her belief to be able to, or be willing to, give up all that she had, how easy her life could have been.
Yes. And she had an infant son who was nursing at that time. And so she knew that that son would be ended up being raised by her family. So there's that piece of it as well. Her husband isn't mentioned. I think so he's not on the scene. Did he leave her because she became Christian, or is he just not in the story? Did he kind of just want to distance himself from her? But she really did lose a lot, and then ultimately her own life. And there were enslaved people with her. Felicitas, or Felicity, gets mentioned as a woman who is enslaved. She's pregnant. We don't know. Sometimes people thought that Felicity was Perpetua's slave. We don't actually know who had enslaved her, but we have some sayings recorded of her as she's giving birth. One of the guards is taunting her, saying, well, you're crying out in birth. It's going to be so much worse when you're martyred. And she says, what I'm suffering now in childbirth, I'm suffering myself. That's me. When I'm martyred, it'll be Christ suffering in me. And she kind of rebukes the guard.
I love the gumption of all these women. That's so great. Another woman that you mentioned that Dr. Marian Taylor has also told me about, and I got so excited about because of my own career, but this is now after Perpetua. So once Christianity becomes a legal religion, we actually start to see men and women traveling to the land of the Bible to see holy sites. Mm-hmm. And you talk about this woman who not only is reading biblical stories at biblical sites, but seems to be compiling either a handbook or at least hints for how other women can do this. Can you tell us more about her?
Yes. So it's in the early 380s of the Common Era, so late 4th century. It's a wealthy woman named Egeria. We're not quite sure if she's from, you know, like a northern Spain or Gaul, but she and a retinue that seems to include some priests and some others traveled to Egypt, Syria, Mesopotamia, Palestine, looking for biblical sites. And it's almost like the Bible is kind of her guide. And so she travels, like, what happens here? You know, and she believes everything that the tour guides tell her, you know, the local people. Yeah. Oh, this is the well where, you know, this happened to Jacob, and this is the valley where this happened. And so she believes all of this, as did most people at that time, of course, would have. And so she kept a kind of travel diary, a journal, and she's writing to some sisters. They may be nuns or sort of consecrated virgins, or there may have been some devout women. So she's writing to other women about her experiences there. And then she had some reference books with her. There had been some guys who had written geography of the Holy Land. And so she's consulting that. And then she would like go to a site with her entourage, and she had a Bible in front of her, like a Latin translation of the New Testament and also a Latin translation of the Greek translation of the Hebrew. So she had all that. And she mentions her library back at home. She gets at one point, she gets a manuscript of a letter that purports to be letters exchanged between Jesus and King Abgar of Edessa. So this fictitious thing. And she says, they gave me a copy of this, and it's longer than the one I have at home.
So she already has a copy.
She has a copy back at home. But she's really delighted at this. But what they would do is, as they traveled, they would stop. They would read the scripture passage related to, you know, like, this is where the quails came, or, this is where this happened. And then a lot of times there were already churches set up as pilgrimage churches. And then one of the priests in her retinue would celebrate the Lord's Supper. And so they would have Eucharist, they would have prayer there. And like every single site ended up with a scripture reading and some kind of prayer and the Lord's Supper, if that was possible. And then she would consult with all the local leaders, the nuns and the monks and the bishops, who were really eager. She must have been high status because she had a retinue. At certain points, the Romans provided a guard for her. And then also like bishops wanted to be her tour guide. Well, let me show you this and I'll bring you there and that kind of thing. So it would have been quite amazing. Jerome, who I mentioned earlier, said he heard about a woman who's probably her, who's like traveling around with the retinue, and he's kind of derisive, like, you know, like she shouldn't have been doing that. She should be maybe more modest and not traveling with a big group of people.
I love it, because when I read your description of her in the book, I thought, that's what I do. I've never heard of her. And of all the geographers that I've read, I mean, Gertrude Bell is a name that comes up often when people talk about women traveling on their own in Palestine. But Gertrude Bell is quite late. And to have someone who's in the 380s, when it's still the Roman Empire, traveling this way, making observations about the land, I like cannot wait to just dig into her journals. I've never even heard that they existed. It's fascinating.
You might also then enjoy reading about and the work by Marjorie Kemp, who is an English woman in the 1400s who goes to Jerusalem and talks about her experiences as well. So a medieval account of pilgrimage.
Okay, I'm taking these with me on my next trip to Israel. Yes. I'm going to read the biblical story and then Egeria's story and just kind of combine them. It'll be really wonderful. I also really had a great time looking through the section when you're in almost like medieval history, I guess. You talk about, or maybe it's prior, because you say prior to the 1400s, almost every woman who wrote a book believed she was the first woman to do so. I'm like, oh, well, that continues now, you know, because we don't have all of these voices. So we tend to think that we're the first one uncovering something. But there were a lot of Christian women who were writing. And those Christian women tended to be those who were in the convent or associated with the convent. And I don't know how often were aware of these nuns, the way that they held this body of literature, this academic pursuit. So how much freedom did these nuns have? And who was reading their work? Was it just for the other nuns, or were they letters that were going in circulation?
That is a great question. So in terms of being like permitted to write, especially matters of theology, one of the strategies that women used, especially someone like Hildegard of Bingen, a 12th century German nun, she would actually have to say, like, well, I got this from God. It's not me, it's God, which is both a powerful thing because I'm speaking for God. But on the other hand, a university trained man could say, I studied this and this is my opinion. Right. But she can't say that. She has to say, and she would sometimes, oh, I'm just a little feather on the breath of God, or I'm just a poor little woman. And then she'd say these really powerful things. So it was like, it's a strategic, a measure of humility, but I think she knew that she was speaking with a kind of force. At one point, she calls herself a small sound of the trumpet. So that you, what trumpet makes a small sound there? So she's using that. But you had to be authorized by God. And then in general, if the women were writing for anyone outside of the community, then it almost always had to be vetted by a man, a clergyman, a learned priest, sometimes a bishop, a theologian. And in fact, the first writings of Hildegard of Bingen, as she was composing her first book, a copy got written and then sent to the Pope. It's like work in progress. And then he says, that sounds good, keep going. And then, of course, her supporter said, oh, the Pope approved this. But that was really helpful to her. And then when she had a certain amount of fame, people would write and ask opinions on things, and she would write letters back. And then sometimes she would just write with her own opinion. Other times she said, I looked to God, looked to the living light, which is how she could have described her inspiration. So there would be times where women were writing for other women. Hildegard actually wrote some sermons, some teachings that were for the nuns to instruct them. Those don't have the same, I learned this from the living light, I learned this from God. Those are her teaching. But if it's going to be going out beyond an immediate circle of women, then divine authority is really, really important.
It's like an obvious, they understood their audience.
Yeah, yeah.
In looking at these women and looking at what they wrote, both of them, are there ways that the women are saying things that the men aren't? Or men and women, as they're interpreting, are they saying very similar things? Or are they just addressing completely different things in the Bible because they have completely different perspectives?
A lot of times they come to the same conclusions about how to interpret different biblical passages, sometimes because they've read the male interpretations. But it's quite often the case that in matters of gender and how to interpret Eve, that there you start to get some differences. So for instance, a woman who was active, you know, in the 1300s and 1400s, Christine de Pizan, said that she describes herself in her study, which is filled with books. So it's private book ownership. And she's kind of actually making reference to that. But then she's reading something that says that women are vile and disgusting. And then she says, like, I asked myself, how could God create something so vile and disgusting? And then three ladies, justice, right thinking, and reason, you know, logic, show up and try to explain that, no, you, like, women are created, fashioned by a creator who loves them, cares for them, and woman is a worthy and noble creation of God. Mm. Or she even attends to the passages about women's tears, and she keeps hearing the complaint, you know, like that women cry too much. And then she says, but Jesus heeded the tears of the penitent women and the widow whose son died. And so Jesus didn't reject their tears. So that would be one of those kind of really striking examples. but most often it's the story of Eve. Sometimes, this is really striking, the story of Dinah or Dina, depending on how one pronounces it, a woman who's sexually assaulted in Genesis 34. And there's a long tradition of women, of men rather, and or it could be others that we don't know about, who blame Dinah for kind of somehow leaving the house, attracting the attention of the perpetrator, and then bringing it about and then enjoying it, and that horrible, horrible stuff that we still hear today. And I think the most progressive interpretation, the earliest kind of progressive interpretation that I've heard, was from a nun writing in the 1600s who said, it wasn't Dinah. Why aren't you blaming the perpetrator? And especially at a time when the story of Dinah was used to say women need to stay at home and sheltered. If you let them go out in public without supervision, this will happen and it'll be their fault anyway. And sometimes it got used to say that women need to be in convents, whether they want to or not. And this woman who doesn't want to be in a convent because her family placed her there, this woman says, no, this is not what happened. And she's probably the first one I noticed to actually note the power differential between David, King David, and Bathsheba at a time when people thought that somehow she was doing something seductive to try to seduce him and entered into it. She's the one who kind of notices that he's got the power and she does not.
Hmm. As we close here, and we've only really talked about a few women in the first half of the book. So there's a lot for people to explore in this book. But in the part that you wrote, was there just anyone who really captured your imagination where discovering her and her story has just remained with you even after the conclusion of the book?
Yes, this is from actually the 19th century chapter, but a part that Marianne and I collaborated on, Jerina Lee, who died in 1864, and she was a freeborn resident of Philadelphia, and she was African American. And she's feeling this internal call to preach. And she visited her minister, the Reverend Richard Allen, who later became bishop of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and said, am I called to preach? And he said, well, women can speak at prayer meetings, but we Methodists don't let women preach. And then she still had this internal feeling, and she heard God say to her, maybe internally, I'll put words in your mouth and turn your enemies to become your friends, which is an echo of Jeremiah's call. She talks about being while she's in her sleep, she has a vision of a pulpit and there's a Bible on it. And then what happened is in her dreams, she took a text, a biblical text, and she preached in her sleep, and the sound of it woke her up and woke up her household. So she's dreaming, and then the preaching, the actual words come out. And then she called her calling, a fire shut up in my bones, which is from Jeremiah 20. And then later on, she's actually at the church, Mother Bethel Church, an African Methodist Episcopal Church. And while the preacher is preaching, she says, well, he seemed to have lost the spirit. And she jumps up from her seat and starts to preach. And she thinks she's going to be in trouble, but then the same preacher, the Reverend Richard Allen, who now a bishop, says, well, she came to me earlier and I, told her not to, but then he affirmed her call to preach, or at least that's what she reports in her autobiography, that there's a kind of bishop commissioning her to do that. And so it's that kind of that persistence. She resisted her call, but there was something in her, and then she just kind of overcame her own hesitation, overcame her own kind of lack of confidence, her own self-censorship, and then it bursts out of her, whether she's in church or asleep, and she goes on to do multiple preaching tours and then writes her autobiography, which one can read to this day.
That is so beautiful. As a resident of Philadelphia, I am familiar with Mother Bethel Church. The building is still there and really wonderful to go visit. And I didn't know her story, though. So that is a beautiful, beautiful story to end on. Thank you for your time today. But for going through the tedious footnotes and notes and pursuing and feeling like the women are worthy of pursuit. I really value that and think that Marion and I talked about how challenging it is to bring in women's voices when you don't know where to go find them. And this book is a beautiful treasure of start here. These are the ones. Go read them.
We quote we mention over 400 women, although we can't go into all of their stories, but that's a place that you can start and then follow the footnotes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your work. I'm so grateful.
Thank you.
I hear these stories and all I want to do is invite these incredible women to the podcast table to hang out with all of us and to share about their life. Since they can't do that, I'm so grateful for the work of Dr. Joy Schrader and Dr. Marion Taylor for researching and writing this book called Voices Long Silenced. Check it out. Read the table of contents, even if you don't buy the book, so that you see the rich diversity of women who have been interpreting scripture for over 2,000 years. Thank you for sitting with us around the podcast table, and a very special thanks goes again and always to my Patreon team. You all know how much I love them and the way they make sure this podcast is sustainable. People like Carol Lloyd, Pastor Jack, David and Julie Longman, Christine So, and Bill and Julie Tucker, along with several others, have all gotten Context Matters to the end of our fourth season. Whoop, whoop. I look back over these seasons and I realize we have been sitting at this table with some pretty fantastic people. If you are new to this podcast, take some time to scroll through our previous episodes. I have my favorites for sure. And if you want to tell me which ones are your favorites, you can find me at my website, narrativeofplace.com. I produced this episode. Luke Bronner of Milieu Media Group did the edits and the final mix, and Peter Lordson of Sycamore Sound created the music. While we take this next little short break and do some prep work for season 5, be safe, take care of each other, and stay curious about the world around you.